Families bond over culture, families bond over food.
To really be culturally humble, you need to understand the context within which you're working. If we don't do everything we can to keep this family intact and this child with their tribe, we ultimately take away from the tribe.
Hello, and welcome back to this five-part podcast series for the Family Contact Improvement Partnership, or FCIP. If you haven't had a chance to listen to the rest of our series, we've had some great discussions on child versus family-centered approaches and engaging foster parents as meaningful partners. Today, for our third episode, we're covering a big topic, culturally centered family contact and how implicit bias can come into play. I'm Kristen Clark, and I'm a social worker in Alaska, and I'm joined again by my co-host, Emily Houck. Hey, Emily.
Hey, Kristen. Thanks. Good to be here. My name is Emily Houck, and I'm a program manager for Alaska Family Services.
So this is a big one, and we can only scratch the surface of this topic in a 20-minute episode, but we brought in two guests who have unique perspectives on the role of implicit bias and the importance of taking a culturally centered approach to family contact.
Why do you think this is such a big subject, Kristen?
Implicit bias is a big topic to cover. Implicit bias, which is also called unconscious bias, refers to attitudes and beliefs that occur outside of our conscious awareness and control. You know, we can see how implicit bias affects child welfare in one big way to start with, and that is the disproportionality that Alaska Native and American Indian children are at higher risk of being removed and of not being returned to their families in Alaska, but really across the nation. We have to be reflecting on this as professionals and people in our community and looking at how our unconscious biases and beliefs can impact the reunification of families or the support of families that we're giving, and how we can unlearn that and undo that together.
A lot of people don't realize they have implicit bias until they start facilitating a family contact.
Our first guest today is Cynthia Smith, who works for the Kinnick Tribe and coordinates their family contact program.
And as we talked about in an earlier episode, family contact is what was formerly known as visitation between bio families and children who have been removed from the home. Family contact is more of a gentler approach, more inclusive approach, and supervised visitation, we would just sit in the room, document what was happening, not really engage. But with the shift to family contact, we're more purposeful in what we do. We get to know the family and their individual needs, and culture is a foundational piece of doing that successfully.
We talk a lot about family contact in this episode. Here's what Cynthia had to say about the importance of taking a culturally centered approach.
My name is Cynthia Smith. I work with Kinnick Tribe. I'm the coordinator for the Family Contact Program. I have been a CASA, which is the court-appointed special advocate, for the past 3 years with the Office of Public Advocacy. And I've additionally been a foster parent for the last 9 years. 8 of those we have provided therapeutic foster care, and additionally adopted one of the youth that came through our home. We have families that are non-ICWA preferred placements, which means they're non-Alaska Native raising ICWA placements. And we communicate with them heavily on, you know, if you need guidance, if you need foods, if you need materials to incorporate their culture, if they've requested something that you're unsure of what it is or you don't know how to get it, communicate with us because we'll figure out a way. We've had non-Alaska Native families in here that the dad, his son was Alaska Native, but he was not. And he was very inquisitive about the Alaska Native culture, and he wanted to learn. He wanted to raise his son knowing his culture. So he actually asked us if we had any cultural foods because he wanted to be able to try them himself to be able to pass that on to his son. So we had muktuk, which is whale blubber. So he, you know, he got to experience that. Families bond over culture. Families bond over food. Every family has culture. Every single family has culture. We have chosen to incorporate meals into our family visits, and it's made a huge difference. The parents, they get excited. They look forward, you know, what can we make next week? What about this, this, or this? You know, we used to do a lot of baking. Could we do cookies? They get excited. They bring in their memories with their children. They bring in their traditions, and we incorporate that into the visit. We had a family. The mother was Alaska Native. The father was not. The mother grew up in Anchorage. She had no roots to her original village from where she was from, her tribe. She didn't practice any of the culture, but her mother did. And so we were able to get approval for her mother to come into visits. And you could sit and you could hear the grandmother speak with the youth. And she would speak their indigenous language, their dialect, to him. So he potentially had a slightly different culture than his own biological parent because of the influence of his grandmother that had helped primarily raise him. You know, there, the cases that we deal with, a lot of these families, it's generational. And we try to keep that at the forefront at all times, that these parents, not all of them, but a lot of them, were these children 30 years ago that maybe nobody stepped in to help. So family is key. Extended family is key. And the Alaska Native culture, there is aunties and uncles, they play a huge part in raising these children. The grandparents play a huge part in raising these children. We have to look at this whole picture. And I think that's a huge struggle. And I see that as a huge struggle. When I read case plans, when I read family contact plans, is they'll state, the uncle can't come. He's there's some concerns there. Well, there's concerns with mom and dad, but they can come. So if those same concerns are uncle because he's abusing substances, so were mom and dad, and they're safe enough to be here. You know, uncle should be here. So there are going to be situations where I absolutely agree that it wouldn't be safe. But a lot of the time, we need to use that same judgment for grandma, grandpa, auntie, uncle, cousins that we use for mom and dad and incorporate them into these visits. People that are raising Alaska Native children, if you're not Native, that's okay. Call your local tribe. Call your children's tribe. If, you know, say the children is from an out-of-region placement, one of the more rural villages, call your local tribe. Putting forth that effort and stepping out of your comfort zone, because it's uncomfortable to ask for help, especially when I was a non-Alaska Native foster parent. And when I got 3 Alaska Native youth from out of region placed in my home, I was a mess. I didn't know what to do. And I connected to Kinnick Tribe. And that was the best thing I could have done for my kids, because they brought them in, you know, hey, they can go to fish camp. They can do this. They can do that. And that's what it takes. The quote, it takes a village to raise a child. That's not just pertaining to an Alaska Native village. That's pertaining to your support system. Every family has culture. Every single family has culture. Every foster parent has culture. Honoring and supporting the foster parent's culture in the home that child is living in. Honoring and supporting the bio parent's culture and the child's culture, because that child may have been removed from the parents, but he may have actually been living with, you know, this distant relative or this family friend when he was removed. So identifying and honoring all of those cultures, it could be a tradition, it could be their religion, it could be the way their house makeup was. You know, maybe they lived, you know, 3 generations all together in one home, and that's part of their culture, the things that they practiced together, the meals they ate, the music they listened to, that's all part of culture. And respecting that and identifying that with all cases is very important.
Implicit bias has caused the loss of a lot of traditions, language, things that really hold a family together. They have lost their sense of center, their sense of self when they're removed. They are taken away from everything they've known because it's been judged that what they have known is not appropriate or not good for them. And that's just not true.
I think that what you just said is powerful, Emily. And what Cynthia's had to say is really important. I think that we really need to be focused on how we engage extended family, how we continue to maintain traditions and connection to culture for every family. When we're thinking about implicit bias, we're looking at all the ways that we expect someone to behave, that we expect someone to do something. And we really need to look at, is this just something that they do differently? Is this something that we can help maintain and support? And if it's safe, why are we stopping it?
Previously, during supervised visitation, we were actually asked to not let people use their native languages because the courts read it off in English. So we had to translate everything that was said, and we don't always have a translator, but that just leads to more loss of language, more loss of culture. But now with Family Contact, we are moving forward. As Cindy pointed out, you know, bring in the uncles, bring in the grandmother that knows the language. It's just really hard to get rid of implicit bias because it is a subconscious thing. It's something that you as a person believe in or were raised with, even if you don't realize it.
You know, coming off of what Cynthia said, everyone has culture, and it's really important to focus on culture, especially for our Alaska Native and American Indian families who continue to be removed at higher rates and are less likely to be returned to their families. And while we have a higher percentage of people who represent those cultures in Alaska, we also have Black and Latinx and Asian and Pacific Islander families, immigrant families, a lot of different people who are also disproportionately affected by implicit bias and have higher rates of removal and lower rates of reunification. For our second guest, we invited Rachel Poor, who is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma.
And Oklahoma is kind of far away from the work we do here in Wasilla, Alaska, but Rachel spent her whole career in child welfare.
Yes, and she does national work, and she has a powerful perspective on why cultural humility is so crucial when working with American Indian and Alaska Native families.
My name is Rachel Foer. I'm a Cherokee Nation citizen living and working here in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. I've spent several years working in child welfare, and I'm pleased to bring some of that experience to being with you today. As a Native person, being culturally humble, it means a few things to me, but the first thing that I think is important, not just for Native families, but for all families, is to understand generational abuse. For your Native families that you're working with, that also encompasses historical trauma. And that historical trauma has typically compounded itself into generational trauma. And that's important because to really be culturally humble, you need to understand the context within which you're working. There is a person that works at NICWA whose name is Terry Cross, and Terry Cross explains culture like this. And I think it's important to understand this when you're talking about being culturally humble, but Terry Cross has explained this as culture is the water that surrounds the fish. And for not only our Native peoples, but any person that you are working with in family contact, you should be considering what is this individual's water and what have they been surrounded with. And that creates a cultural humility when you want to stay curious and be mindful and learn about what this person might need now to feed them in this space. To really be culturally humble, workers need to understand their biases is one of the first things. Having done some work, figuring out what their biases are so that they might consider where those are coming up, because when those come up, those usually stop someone from the ability to be culturally humble. And not being biased that maybe the way in which you were raised is the right and only way for families to exist and live with one another. To ask curious questions about what could help facilitate their family contact time. And so I think that's just the first step, entering into these family contact interactions with cultural humility to help be a guide, but also be a learner along the path with the family. As a Native person, understanding being culturally centered, I would add that being culturally centered means you also, as the person in supervising or entering into family contact with the family, that you yourself have taken a few minutes to ground yourself spiritually, mentally, emotionally, And that's the way we are taught to engage with each other in our Native communities. But it's just a deep respect for the space that we're sharing and the time we're sharing together. Knowing that typically families that are involved in the child welfare system are existing in a lot of chaos and trying to navigate this system, we need to come to them in a culturally appropriate way, which I think begins being with culturally humble. And then secondly, being centered ourselves and balanced in our approach with them. Native people believe that our children are sacred. They have particular gifts and abilities that the Creator has gifted them at birth. And those gifts are to be used in and amongst the community. Everyone's gifts are sacred because they are the continuation of our culture and our community. And that's how our communities come together and thrive. And so the word sacred sometimes can be watered down. So I want to take the moment to say here, you really have to understand that the sacredness is not just about the child itself. It is the gifts and abilities that the child brings to the community. And so the sacredness isn't just tied to this child as a being, it is a child also as the part of the community. Understanding sacredness of a child to a tribal community means that you also consider that if we don't do everything we can to keep this family intact and this child with their tribe, that we ultimately take away from the tribe, because the child being removed removes those gifts that the Creator has given to them to be used for and in their communities. And that is different. And it is more impactful to think about as a person doing family contact. But I would also challenge that thinking about the child as sacred could also drive you to be more curious about their culture. And when you're being curious about their culture and living in that as a culturally humble person, you will find out more about these families that can help you with resiliency activities and ways to do family contact, where it might be appropriate, who you can gather as like a family time supporter to be part of these family contacts, to strengthen the connection between the family, even while the child is placed in out-of-home care. And that path becomes much more doable if you see the child as sacred, because if you can see the child as sacred and see that they belong with their family, the case plan starts to create itself and the family contact and resiliency activities start to create themselves. And all of that leading together, we know that good family contact breeds better outcomes for all of these cases. There's probably two things that I hope that people come to understand. One is sometimes it's confusing for people how dependent Indigenous families can be on systems themselves. And so anyone who sees that and instantly takes it as a kind of a negative thought, I would ask them to do some work on learning about what has caused the historical trauma for many American Indian and Alaska Natives, because a lot of that process that has gone on through the years has been facilitated to make Native peoples dependent upon the government. And that is, you know, a bias that I've seen show up in many, many places and many, many times. So I would ask people that see that to really do some true work trying to understand how an oppressive, you know, federal government and many broken treaties and many, many tribes over many, many years has resulted in generational trauma that does cause Native peoples to act dependent upon the federal government. And that's how it still exists sometimes to this day. The second thing I would want people to know is that culture matters, and it matters in such a deep way. And a lot of times that culture is also their religion. So lots of people seem to resonate with how deeply connected they are to their religion. And so I would hope that they could transfer that same thought into what culture means for an Indigenous person. And I am one Indian person from one tribe, and there are many, many tribes and many, many religions all across the United States that have very different ways of being. But at the basis of most everyone is the interconnectedness to one another. From my time at Cherokee Nation, I have a bracelet that says Dila Jailaga, and that means we belong to one another. And that was a grounding value for us as a group of managers, as we worked cases, had discussions, made determinations, discussed policy, is that no matter what, Dila Jailaga is there with us, and we all belong to one another. So the decisions that we make affect not just us for today, but for our ancestors to come, and that we were placed in our roles by our ancestors before us. And that's why it matters so deeply, why we consider culture in family contact, and why we work to be culturally humble, understanding, you know, those some of the concepts in the innovative practices training of ambiguous loss and historical and intergenerational trauma and how it affects people.
Well, Rachel really highlighted a lot of topics. And I think that what Rachel said really brings me back to thinking about what strengthens our communities really. It's the importance of ensuring that we are remaining curious, that we are connected to one another, that we understand the sacred space that we're in when we are in a family's most vulnerable moment, trying to help support them. And the importance of doing our own work continually, you know, learning history, understanding the impact of historical trauma, and understanding the beauty that everyone brings to the table through their strengths and their gifts, and how that can support people getting stronger together, keeping people intact, keeping families intact, and supporting them is what allows our community to strengthen and stay connected.
And you really can't do that unless you put aside your own implicit bias and have the family contact meeting at the beginning and really talk to them and get to know them and their families and their traditions and, you know, what gifts do they bring, as Rachel pointed out, to their families. And this is what will make family contact successful for these families.
Right. And remembering that just because you've worked with a family from one culture doesn't mean that we know how the next family is going to be, right? There's so many different cultures. There's so many different traditions that people hold, and they're all really important, you know? So we just have to continue to do our own work and reflect on how we're showing up and what we're doing, and remember to ask questions, remember to be present with the people who are in front of us. This podcast is produced by the Butler Institute for Families at the University of Denver with support from Rock Matsu and the Family Contact Improvement Partnership. Production by Sarah Roman, story collection by Krista Doty, with support from Carol Wilcox, Emily Haup, and me. I'm Kristen Clark. Please join us next time when we discuss holding family contact in the parent home.